It's a bit chilly. We're going to be looking at a temperature this afternoon, 53 degrees. It'll feel like the 40s with the wind, but the wind's going to die down tonight. So nice weather for trick-or-treating. The overnight low should drop down to about 40. Tomorrow, sunshine, a little warmer, high 57. Wednesday, sunshine, high 67. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans for 1490 WGCH.
Around the House with Steve Gladstone on Saturday mornings from 8 to 10 is jam-packed with important information, preventative maintenance, and all sorts of home tips to keep your house in great shape and your family safe. We have special guests on heating, cooling, environmental issues, and we make it fun with trivia contests and prizes. Don't let that home fall apart around you. Join us Saturday mornings from 8 to 10 on Around the House with Steve Gladstone on 1490 WGCH.
The opinions expressed in our talk shows are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio. And now, the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour on 1490 WGCH.
Good afternoon. This is Beth O'Malley on Be Well with Beth, with the Greenwich Sentinel programming on WGCH 1490. I am here today with Dr. Susan K. Buble, who is the chief of the Division of Breast Surgery at Mount Sinai Beth Israel, as well as the associate professor of surgery at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Good. I am so much looking forward to our discussion today. And we were talking earlier about you're also a Greenwich mom.
I am.
And
it's a great place to raise kids.
Yeah, it is. And we're so blessed to have you here in our community. And to I know you work out of New York City, but so many of the residents here know you personally, have known you as their surgeon and their physician, and you show up for folks in a way that, you know, you really don't see every day from every physician. So we appreciate your being a part of our community. And what I wanted to do is really kind of a breast cancer awareness 101 today and go into all different topics. I've said to you before, I know so little about breast cancer. My aunt was diagnosed and had back many years ago stem cell treatment, and is doing great. She's done wonderfully with the treatment and has not had a reoccurrence, and we're so happy for that. In terms of my knowledge about breast cancer, I go for my mammograms, but that's about all the basic knowledge I have, because I haven't been confronted with having to get a biopsy or anything like that. So let me ask you this. When I started getting mammograms, I want to say I was around 40 years old. And I know there's been so much press in the last 2-3 years about when do you start getting mammograms, how often. Can you speak to what the current research is on that and what the recommendations are today?
Well, it's probably one of the most controversial areas in the field of breast disease around. At what age, how often? And the amazing thing is all of these bodies of knowledge, these societies that give out their recommendations, the American Cancer Society, the U.S. Task Force, they're all looking at the same body of literature, all of the same studies, and yet coming up with very different conclusions. So the tried and true recommendation always has been and remains starting yearly mammograms at 40 years old and continuing, you know, and there's no end date. It just depends on your overall health. If you have end-stage lung cancer, meaning you have a year to live, you're not going to get a mammogram. So there's no end date on when you should get a mammogram, meaning there's no cutoff. It just depends on your personal health. So that's been the recommendation for years and years and years. And several years ago, the U.S. Task Force looked at similar studies and said, you know what, start getting mammograms at 50 years old and don't get them every year. Get them every other year until 70 years old. So really, what they're recommending, and this is all for average risk women, and that's very important to remember. This is not if you have a strong family history, if your sister had breast cancer at 30 years old, things like that. Then you're not average risk. So these recommendations are for average risk women. So the U.S. task force said start at 50 years old, get them every other year until 70. So really, in your lifetime, only get 10 mammograms. And that was their recommendation, provided everything's fine on them. The American Cancer Society said, you know what? We don't love that recommendation. And we've analyzed the data. And this is what we come up with, that from 40 to 44 years old, mammograms are optional. Well, the reality is they're always optional. You know, we make recommendations, and as individuals, we choose to follow some and not others. So they said between 40 and 44 years old, they're optional. At 45 is when you should start having mammograms, and no real cutoff date as you get older. Then there's the American College of Radiology, the American College of Gynecology, all these major societies that deal with breast cancer and breast disease. And they still hold true that start getting mammograms again for average risk women at 40 years old and continue yearly, and no specific cutoff date. It's based on your own health. So if science is confusing, and if all of these recommendations are different, I'm not sure how the average woman is supposed to know when to start getting mammograms based on this. It's highly controversial and confusing. Now, the interesting thing is, the question is, why are there so many different recommendations? And it's primarily, everyone agrees, the American Cancer Society, the U.S. Task Force, everyone else agrees, mammograms save lives. Early detection saves lives.
Right.
The question is, how many mammograms do we have to do, meaning on how many women to save one life? And that's where, when you get into the science. Now, if you personalize that, you say, well, I don't care how many mammograms on how many people you have to do, but to save one life, that's what we do. Well, when you look at it on a population basis, that's not how screening recommendations are made. So that's part of the controversy. The other issue is that the end result always is, when we look at these studies, is overall survival. A woman's diagnosed with breast cancer, does she survive? Well, the survival from breast cancer, because of early detection and our treatments, is so good that it's getting harder and harder to find a difference with overall survival with these studies.
Oh, wow. But what about women under 40? Because you hear of this. I've heard of several women under 40 who have been diagnosed with breast cancer. How do they find out they have it if they're not having mammograms? Is it just by discovering a lump one day in the shower, that type of thing?
There are absolutely women under 40 who are diagnosed with breast cancer. There are women in their 20s that are diagnosed with breast cancer. An important point is, if you do feel a mass, you're not too young for breast cancer.
Okay.
You're never too young. So I have women who come into my office all the time and they say, well, I noticed this mass a year ago, but you know, my doctor said, oh, it can't be anything, you're too young. Well, you're never too young. Breast cancer doesn't read a textbook and say, oh, you're only 23 years old, this can't be breast cancer. Well, it can be. It's not the norm.
Okay.
It certainly is not the norm. Most breast masses in young women, women in their 20s and 30s, are not cancer. But the take-home message is that if there is something that you notice or something that your doctor notices, it does have to be evaluated.
Okay, that makes sense. What about, I think that many of us have this thought in our head that if no one in my family has breast cancer, I don't need to be as concerned as someone who does. What can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly important point to make. And I see it every day. Women will come in at 60 years old with a breast mass and they had been diagnosed with breast cancer and they had never had a mammogram before that. And I'll say, you know, why did you not have a mammogram? Because it's important as a physician to know where someone's coming from and what biases do they go in and what beliefs do they hold and what's important to them. And frequently I'll hear, well, no one in my family has it, so I figured I was never getting it, so I didn't need a mammogram. So a few things. Number one, mammograms do not prevent breast cancer. It's another thought pattern that I see frequently is, well, how did I get breast cancer? I get my mammograms every year. Mammograms do not prevent breast cancer.
Right.
In fact, the purpose of a mammogram is to diagnose breast cancer, not prevent it. So hopefully, if you're getting mammograms every year and you are diagnosed with breast cancer, it is a small, early stage breast cancer.
Got it.
That's the goal.
And the earlier you find a sign of a problem, the better treatment outcomes are?
Typically, as we move on in our knowledge of breast cancer, we're learning that there's a whole lot more involved in how someone does with breast cancer than the size of it.
Okay.
So is it part of, it's part of it, but it certainly does not determine outcome just based on size. So mammograms do not prevent breast cancer. The goal of a mammogram is to detect breast cancer and detect it early. Something that most people are not aware of is family history is a risk factor, but it's only important if you have a family history. The reality is about 80% of women who are diagnosed with breast cancer have no one else in their family with it.
Is that right? 80%?
A huge number. So the majority of women who are diagnosed with breast cancer have no one else in their family. But remember, that's average risk.
Right, right. Well, what can I do to modulate my risk as a woman?
Well, there's not a whole lot of things that we have in our control about breast cancer. When you think of the major risk factors of breast cancer, number one risk factor is being a woman. Number two risk factors, getting older. So the two major risk factors we have no control of. The third major risk factor is family history, but again, only if you have one. If you do not have a family history of breast cancer, you're at average risk. When we talk about family history, really important to know that your mom's family history and your dad's family history are equally important because you get half your genes from your mom and half from your father. So there's plenty of people who don't have any family history of breast cancer on your mother's side, but your father's family, every woman has it. Well, that's as significant as if that history were on your mother's side. So important to know both.
So that's a myth out there, because I had heard you only look at your mother's side years ago.
Complete myth.
Okay.
And unfortunately, many of these myths continue to go on and on and on.
Okay.
Family history, that if you don't have anyone in your family with breast cancer, you won't get it. Wrong. We know that the majority of women who get breast cancer have no one in their family with it. So lots of these myths, unfortunately. The other important factor about family history is not only that someone in your family has breast cancer, but it's what relative, how close are they to you? Are they first-degree relatives? Are they second-degree relatives? Are they third-degree relatives? But also, what age were they diagnosed at? So if your mom has breast cancer at 85 years old, or your mom has breast cancer at 35 years old, that's a major difference for your risk of developing breast cancer.
And it's more significant the younger the family member?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned that being a woman, is there such thing as breast cancer in men?
Yes. About 1% of all breast cancers diagnosed every year are in men.
Son of a gun. Yeah. I had no idea.
Yeah, men have breasts also.
Right.
They don't have nearly the degree of breast tissue as women do, but they certainly have breast tissue, so they can develop breast cancer. So if a male develops a breast mass, very important, equally important to get that checked out.
Okay, very good to know. What I would like to do is I just was reading an article about the impact of alcohol use, and I had no idea there was a correlation. So what I'd like to do when we come back, we're going to take a short break and then discuss some modifiable lifestyle changes that we can make to lessen our risk.
Do we get wine with the break?
No. Oh. This is Beth O'Malley with Dr. Susan Buble on 1490 WGCH, part of the Greenwich Sentinel programming. We'll be right back.
From the WGCH Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans with your Doppler Weather Radar Forecast. WGCH brings you up-to-the-minute weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Lots of sunshine. It's windy. It's a bit chilly. We're going to be looking at a temperature this afternoon, 53 degrees. It'll feel like the 40s with the wind, but the wind's going to die down tonight. So nice weather for trick-or-treating. The overnight low should drop down to about 40. Tomorrow, sunshine, a little warmer, high 57. Wednesday, sunshine, high 67. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans for 1490 WGCH.
Hi, I'm Scott France. I believe that how we handle bad news is the difference between turning things around and making them worse. No one likes to hear bad news. I certainly don't. As your state senator, it is important to me that you as citizens and voters know about the challenging fiscal situation in the state of Connecticut and how slowly our economy is growing. Many members of the majority party in Hartford want to pretend that Connecticut is doing just fine. They want to talk about everything except the complete failure of Connecticut's current economic policy. It is way past the time to get serious about Connecticut's finances. What Hartford Democrats and Governor Malloy have been doing clearly is not working. My priorities are crystal clear and likely the same as yours. Number one, fiscal responsibility. Number two, job creation. And number three, thinking creatively to generate solutions to tough problems like education, transportation, and caring for our most vulnerable citizens. I'm Scott France, and I enthusiastically approve this message.
Paid for by France for State Senate, Robert Oka, Treasurer.
Welcome back to the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour. This is Beth O'Malley with Be Well with Beth. And I am here today with Dr. Susan K. Buble. She is from Mount Sinai Beth Israel and a Greenwich resident. Dr. Buble is the chief of the Division of Breast Cancer at Mount Sinai, and we're thrilled to have her here really hashing through breast cancer in the year 2000 and, what are we, 17?
We're 16. But
that's 16.
Okay. We're close to 17. We're getting there. Every day we're a little closer.
Yeah. I'm sitting here going, I've been on vacation for about a week and a half now. I have no idea where I am or what year it is. So we are looking at Breast Cancer 101, basically bringing us up to date in the community on what we should do as both women and as men are susceptible to breast cancer and what we should do to modify our lifestyle in terms of helping bring down our risk. And where we left off a few moments ago, you know, we were joking about having a glass of wine, but the truth of the matter is that, as I understand it, alcohol, weight loss, and exercise all factor into our risk.
Well, you know, when you look at the risk factors for breast cancer, most of them we cannot control. We cannot control being women, we cannot control getting older, and we cannot control our family history. So there are a few things that we can control and modify in our life. Being overweight, which we know is basically an epidemic in our country, is a real risk factor for breast cancer, especially gaining weight after menopause. That increases our risk. And if you think about it, why do we develop breast cancer? And the reasons for developing breast cancer are really so multifactorial. When I give talks to the community, I have this one slide that has all pieces of a puzzle, and I have about 50 pieces with a reason that you could get breast cancer from on each piece. And that's just one slide. I could have five slides like that because it really is that multifactorial.
Wow.
So it's rarely one reason why you get breast cancer. But our ovaries produce hormones and they stimulate the breast tissue. Once we go through menopause, the ovaries are no longer producing hormones, estrogen, progesterone, different hormones. When we gain weight, what happens is, especially after menopause, estrogen is then produced in fat cells. So the more fat cells we have, the more estrogen. Well, if you've already gone through menopause, your breast should not be exposed to that much estrogen, because the longer the breast tissue is exposed to estrogen, the higher the risk of developing breast cancer. So if you get your period quite young and you go through menopause quite late, your breasts are exposed to a larger amount of estrogen, thereby increasing your risk. Now, are these huge increases? No, but every increase is important. So,
got it.
Being overweight is a definite risk factor for breast cancer, especially if you've had breast cancer, especially hormone receptor breast cancer, meaning breast cancer that is sensitive to either estrogen or progesterone. If you gain weight or continue to be overweight, that increases your risk of a recurrence.
Okay.
So if you've had breast cancer, really important to lose weight if you're overweight. The other thing is exercise. And we have several studies now that show that exercise after a diagnosis of breast cancer decreases your risk of developing breast cancer.
Is that right?
So really important thing. So, you know, we have a ton of reasons why we should be exercising. There's just another reason to decrease your risk of breast cancer and to maintain ideal body weight. So really important. The other modifiable risk factor is alcohol. And this is the one that no one wants to hear. So if you're on your way for, you know, lunch with a glass of wine, you can just turn down the volume for a moment. Is there a magic number of drinks per week that we know you should not exceed? And there's, unfortunately, there's really not. There's some studies that show 4 drinks a week will increase your risk of breast cancer. So, you know, what I tell my patients, I don't say don't have any alcohol, but I do say to modify it. If you're having 2 glasses of wine with dinner every night, cut that down to 1. And 2 glasses of wine doesn't sound like a lot, but if you carry it forward and think about it, because if you're having 2 glasses of wine, you think it's not really that big a deal. But on average, there's 4 glasses in a bottle.
Right.
So every 2 days, you're drinking a bottle of wine. Well,
sure.
Every week, you're drinking about 3 bottles of wine. Every month, you alone are drinking a case of wine. Now, all of a sudden, that sounds like a lot.
Yeah, that's very significant.
Right, but 2 glasses of wine a day doesn't sound like that much.
Right.
But when you really carry this forward and think, how much wine are you consuming just by having 2 glasses a day? That's a case a month that just you alone are drinking.
Right. You know, it's interesting. We look at our risk factors when I do an assessment in the mental health field, and that's a great way to really show why it's important not to be at 2 glasses of wine. And, you know, the mentality that folks have of, I need to get home from work and to relax and take the edge off to use alcohol for that, as opposed to maybe getting home from work and playing with the dog or going for a run or doing something like yoga or meditation.
I was just going to say, I'm an enormous believer in the yoga and meditation and in the mind, body, spiritual, you know, arena. And it really does all tie in together. And it's amazing that schools are starting to catch on to the mind, body,
yes,
the whole mindfulness experience. And it really mm-hmm. matters. In my children's school here in Greenwich, 1 to 2 times a week, they have a whole mindfulness session. Or mindful session.
Yeah, mindfulness.
Yeah, and it's really important. So,
and they're learning yoga in school?
They do yoga and they do meditation.
Oh, they do meditation
yeah.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new, I think it's a relatively new book out called The Morning Minute, and it's like, you know, the skinniest little book, but it gives really good advice. When we come back, I'll share who the author is of that. In terms of doing just a little routine in the morning that includes both meditation and mindfulness and really brings your day forward and gives lots of research as to why that can be so effective. Good. So going forward, I need to be aware of my alcohol consumption, looking at a healthy weight, and increasing exercise. And are there any recommendations for how many times a week or how much exercise, cardio versus weight?
I think the goal is a combination, because it's not only for breast cancer. There's lots of cancers that being overweight can increase your risk for. And ASCO, which is the American Society of Clinical Oncology, really the overarching society for cancer in our country, has suggested that by, I think it's 2025, that obesity will be the number one risk for cancer, surpassing tobacco.
Wow.
So it's a real epidemic and a real problem in our country that we need to start facing. I talk to patients about this every single day. And if you think about an infant, you have children, I have children, routines for infants were so important and for toddlers were so important. Well, just because we're adults does not mean that routines are not important. As you said, it's really important to wake up and start your day on a positive note. Take the 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes to meditate, do some exercise. And if you don't do it in the morning, do the exercise in the evening. But a routine is really important. It's once you start exercising, you see the benefits. And I'm not talking about just with your body, but you see the benefits with your mind. There are definite endorphins that are released.
Right.
And that's why people can get addicted to exercise. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't recommend that either. There definitely has to be a balance in life. And if we live life in moderation, I think that we'd all be better off. But routines are really important.
It's just mind-boggling to me that when you work out in the morning, that for the rest of the day, there's no fatigue. The moods of my patients are far superior than on the days they don't work out. If there's any underlying depression or anxiety, it practically wipes it clean. I always say to folks who are coming in with depression and anxiety, the first thing we want to do is try natural ways of healing, as opposed to going right to the SSRI. And so, we'll start with healthy diet, adding vitamins in, looking at vitamin D, D3, B12s, folic acid, and then let's introduce exercise. If you're not doing anything, let's at least get you out walking, being in the sun, because that's all going to make significant changes in mood.
Well, as we approach the winter and the shorter light during the day, it's really important, because seasonal affective disorder is real,
right?
And exercise helps with that. And you know, again, it's the routine. And so many people, when you ask why they don't exercise, I don't have time, I can't fit it into my day. And truly, once you start the routine, you find the time.
Yep. All right. Thank you very much. What we're going to do is take a short break and then come back and discuss the difference between mammograms and ultrasounds. I know that there's some confusion out there on when you would get one versus the other versus both. I also want to spend some time talking about mastectomies and a little bit about menopause, too, because when you started speaking about the estrogen levels, I wanted to clarify perimenopausal versus menopausal for our listeners. So thank you very much. And this is Beth O'Malley with the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour. Be well with Beth. And we'll be right back with Dr. Susan Bobel.
From the WGCH Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans with your Doppler weather radar forecast. WGCH brings you up-to-the-minute weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Lots of sunshine. It's windy. It's a bit chilly. We're going to be looking at a temperature this afternoon, 53 degrees. It'll feel like the 40s with the wind, but the wind's going to die down tonight. So nice weather for trick-or-treating. The overnight low should drop down to about 40. Tomorrow, sunshine, a little warmer, high 57. Wednesday, sunshine, high 67. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans for 1490 WGCH.
We invite you to listen this Tuesday morning at 9:30 for an enlightening show, Good Living with Michelle Thomas. It'll bring a smile to your face, a few laughs, and the warmth of knowing how fortunate we are. Michelle will discuss topics that highlight good living for those in their golden years and caring for aging parents. We invite you to listen to Good Living with Michelle Thomas this Tuesday morning at 9:30 on 1490 WGCH.
Hi, this is Beth O'Malley with the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour on 1490 WGCH. I am here with Dr. Susan Bobel, and we are talking about breast cancer. Dr. Bobel is a breast surgeon at Mount Sinai Beth Israel, and she's joined us today to dispel some myths. In about 10 minutes, we're going to be opening up the phone lines, and you can jot down this number if you'd like to call in with any questions on breast cancer, breast surgery, what have you. And the number is 203-661-5051. Again, 203-661-5051. So we were just talking a bit about the risk factors and how to modulate one's risk. The next thing I want to move into is I had some questions for you in regard to the estrogen and the link to menopause, and then menopause versus perimenopausal. So can you explain, well, when do you know, how do you know you're in menopause? I keep thinking I'm in it, and then I'm not in it, and then I think I'm back. Well, when, explain.
You don't go in and out of menopause. The strict definition of menopause is 1 year without your period.
Ah.
So prior to that, you are not in menopause. So that's the strict definition. The other thing is that your doctor can get blood work and measure levels of hormones and determine are you in menopause or not. But women can have symptoms of menopause for years leading up to menopause and then for years once they're in menopause. So once you're in menopause, you don't go out of menopause.
Got it.
It doesn't work that way.
Well, how long does perimenopausal, that period last for?
So what you're really referring to is symptoms of menopause. Hot flashes,
yes.
Mood swings, insomnia, difficulty sleeping, early morning waking. Some of the things that might sound like depression.
Right.
Also. And women can have depression surrounding this. And it's, they can complain of, I'm having difficulty losing weight, I don't have the energy. And those are all symptoms of menopause. Those symptoms, some women start those symptoms 10 years before they go through menopause. Some women never have those symptoms.
Okay.
I usually say it's better to ask their spouse about their moodiness than ask them or their children.
Their children,
yeah. They're not always the best judge of whether they're moody or not. Somehow everyone around them gets moody, but they're fine.
Right, so, right.
So it is, it can go on for years. Average age of menopause is 50 or 51 years old. Some women go through menopause, though, at 45. Some women at 57 are still getting their period. Very unhappy about it, but they can still be getting their period. So there's no set age of now I must go through menopause because I'm that old.
Okay. All right. Good to know. In terms of a mammogram versus an ultrasound, recently my OB sent me in for both, and when I got there, the doctor there consulted with my OB, and they figured out that really all I needed was just an ultrasound, not a mammogram. I was confused by the whole thing.
Well, you've just confused me.
Okay.
Are you sure you did not just need a mammogram and not an ultrasound?
I'm not sure, but I think it was for a skin tag, so it was superficial.
Right. So mammograms are really x-rays of the breast.
Okay.
So easiest way to think about it. Lots of women will talk about, well, I don't want a mammogram because of the radiation. The reality is the radiation dose from a mammogram is exceedingly low. And the comparison, especially the American Cancer Society has put out that, and this was several years ago, that you get more radiation flying from here to California than you do with a mammogram.
Is that right?
Just by being in the atmosphere. So the mammogram dose is exceedingly low. And the dose of radiation depends also on the depth of penetration. How far are we looking into the body? So with a mammogram, we're really looking at soft tissue. So we're not, we don't need a mammogram to penetrate bones and things like that. So it's really soft tissue. So the dose is not high.
Okay.
An ultrasound depends on sound waves, so it's not radiation at all. Now, so there's a difference between a mammogram and an ultrasound. Ultrasound and sonogram, same thing. It's interesting that we are in Connecticut because Connecticut was the first state to pass a breast density law. Now, when someone has dense breasts, what that means is they have more breast tissue than fatty tissue. So underneath the skin, there's two types of tissue. There's breast tissue, which is fairly firm and nodular, and then there's fatty tissue, which is something like jello. Some women have dense breasts, which means they have more breast tissue than fatty tissue, and other women just have fatty breasts. It's not good or bad, and you can't really modulate that very much. Women who are still getting their period frequently have dense breast tissue. It's not necessarily a good or bad thing, although some newer studies are showing that having dense breast tissue is a minor risk factor for breast cancer. But on a mammogram, when we look at a mammogram, when we look at breast tissue on a mammogram, it shows up as white on a mammogram. Fatty tissue shows up as gray or black. Masses also show up as white. So it's sort of looking for a polar bear on a glacier.
Wow.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
So looking for something white, a white mass on a white background of dense breast tissue is fairly difficult, which is why in that situation, we recommend someone have an ultrasound in addition to a mammogram, not in replacement, not replacing the mammogram.
Got it.
But in addition to the mammogram. Right now, a mammogram is still the gold standard for breast cancer screening.
Okay, got it. Can someone have dense breasts and then not have dense breasts a few years later? And if so, why?
Yeah, what happens is when we are still getting our periods, the hormones that our ovaries are producing and other parts of our body produce stimulate the breast tissue and really keep it alive. As we approach menopause and as women go through menopause, those hormone levels drop greatly and they're no longer stimulating the breast tissue. So frequently, the density of our breasts decreases as we get older. Now, there are some women who've gone through menopause that still have dense breasts, but frequently, the majority of the time, that dense breast tissue goes away and is replaced by fatty tissue. So because you need a mammogram and ultrasound today does not mean 15 years from now you will still need a mammogram and ultrasound. The other times that we recommend an ultrasound are if you have a mammogram and they see a mass on the mammogram. Can't really differentiate what that is. So they can see a mass and it's sort of a yes, there's a mass there, or no, there's not. But if there is, then the next step is an ultrasound because it can give us much more information about a mass.
Okay, that's helpful to know. When we speak about hormone replacement then for women with menopause, as you're talking in my mind, I'm thinking, well, then is hormone replacement a risk factor for breast cancer?
Yes, it absolutely is. And that's been known since about 2001 or 2002, where a large study came out saying that the combination of estrogen and progesterone, which is the most common hormone replacement, does increase your risk of breast cancer. And the longer you're on it, the higher your risk of breast cancer. So overnight, the use of hormone replacement in our country decreased drastically. Now, for women, and a lot of this does come down to a quality of life issue, for women who are going through menopause and are absolutely miserable with hot flashes and night sweats and moodiness, the recommendation is that you can be on hormone replacement, but for a short time, 6 months, a year, and reassess. So before this large study came out, women would be given a prescription for hormone replacement once they went through menopause, and they'd say, how long do I stay on it? The answer was forever. that no longer is true. The goal is, if we have to put someone on hormone replacement, to get them off it as quickly as possible. There's a lot in the news about synthetic hormone replacement or natural hormone replacement.
Right. Herbal.
Herbal
remedies.
Right. The reality is, our bodies just know that hormones are hormones. And whether they're bioidentical hormones or synthetic hormones, hormones are hormones. There are not any large-scale studies saying that bioidentical hormones are any different to our body than synthetic hormones. The reality is, once we are giving estrogen and progesterone back to our system after menopause, we're increasing our risk of cancer. Now, the caveat to that is, it appears that it's the combination of estrogen and progesterone hormone replacement that increases your risk. If you've had a hysterectomy, which is removing your uterus, then you only need to take estrogen for hormone replacement. You don't need the progesterone. And taking estrogen alone does not appear to increase your risk of breast cancer. So for women who've had a hysterectomy for a variety of reasons, they can take hormone replacement because it's estrogen alone. But for women with their uterus, they do need to take estrogen and progesterone, and that is what increases their risk of breast cancer, the combination.
Thank you. I'm really glad that you clarified that piece.
You're ripping up your prescription for hormone replacement now? That's what that paper was.
No. Not yet. But tell me this. There, with regard to breast surgeries, when you perform a breast surgery nowadays, we're looking at some women wanting to prophylactically have a mastectomy. Sometimes it's because something has been found. And I'm really curious what your opinion as a physician is and as a breast surgeon is on this topic. What I want to do is just hold off so we can take a short break. When we come back, I'm going to ask Dr. Bobel to answer that question, as well as feel free to call in at any point during the next segment, 203-661-5051. And this is Beth O'Malley with the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour with Dr. Susan Bobel on Be Well with Beth.
From the WGCH Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans with your Doppler Weather Radar Forecast. WGCH brings you up-to-the-minute weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Lots of sunshine. It's windy. It's a bit chilly. We're going to be looking at a temperature this afternoon, 53 degrees. It'll feel like the 40s with the wind, but the wind's going to die down tonight. So nice weather for trick-or-treating. The overnight low should drop down to about 40. Tomorrow, sunshine, a little warmer, high 57. Wednesday, sunshine, high 67. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans for 1490 WGCH.
Hi, I'm Jen Graziano. Tune in Wednesday mornings, 9:30 a.m. for Time to Talk. We will encourage conversations regarding sensitive topics that we all need to prepare for. We will cover issues that span from legal planning to emotional and spiritual guidance and so much more. Join me for this important program Wednesday mornings, 9:30 a.m. on 1490 WGCH and WGCH.com anywhere.
Hi, this is Beth O'Malley, and we're here this afternoon with Dr. Susan Bobel at the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour on Be Well with Beth. And I would like to welcome you back. And just before we left off, I mentioned that callers are welcome to call in at any point in time, and we'll keep your call on hold until we have a chance to break for that question. Feel free, though, to start calling in now. I was asking Dr. Bobel in regard to mastectomies and having ones when you're diagnosed with breast cancer versus having a prophylactic mastectomy. And I wanted to get a sense, a medical opinion on that.
The interesting thing is, if you read People magazine and listen to the media, The thought is that every woman with breast cancer is having a bilateral mastectomy. That is far from the truth. The overwhelming number of women with breast cancer continue to have lumpectomies. Greater than 65% of women in our country have lumpectomy for their breast cancer. There are women who need to have a mastectomy.
Oh, okay.
Because of the location of the cancer, the size of the cancer, the fact that there's cancer in multiple areas of the breast. There's many reasons why one would need a mastectomy. So there are, most women get lumpectomies for their breast cancer. Some women need to have a mastectomy, and there are others who choose to have a mastectomy for their breast cancer. And that's a very personal decision, and it's based on their experience with breast cancer frequently, and it's also based on fear. So for women who have a genetic mutation, which is a change or abnormality in the genes that you're born with that predispose you for breast cancer, those are women that may opt to remove both of their breasts even without a diagnosis of breast cancer. And that's because their lifetime risk of developing breast cancer is extraordinarily high. So if you look at average lifetime risk of developing breast cancer, it's 1 in 8, or about 11, 12%. If someone has a genetic mutation, primarily BRCA1 or BRCA2, those are the two most common genetic mutations with breast cancer, their lifetime risk of developing breast cancer is up to about 85%. So an enormous increase in the risk of developing breast cancer. Those women may opt to have a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy. That means remove your breast without having breast cancer. So, and by doing that, you're decreasing your risk of developing breast cancer by over 90-95%. But that's not the norm. It's, if we look at all breast cancer in our country, only about 5-8% is due to one of these genetic mutations. So not incredibly common.
Okay. And would you say it's rare that a woman chooses for a double mastectomy prophylactically?
No, we know about 10% of women undergoing breast cancer surgery will opt to have a bilateral mastectomy.
Okay.
It's not prophylactic because they have cancer.
I see.
One breast would be prophylactic.
Yep.
And there's many reasons why they do that. If they have watched every woman in their family die of breast cancer, without a doubt, their preference is going to be to remove their breast. The reconstruction that we do these days is unbelievable. So the cosmetic appearance is great. We frequently do nipple sparing mastectomies. So we remove the breast tissue but leave all of the skin and the nipple in place. So the only thing that you can see is a scar, but the breast looks like their breast. Now,
would a woman choose to have an implant at that point in time?
You can have an implant or use your own tissue, what we call autologous reconstruction, using your own tissue, frequently from the abdominal area.
I was just going to ask. That's where I would want you to lose it
from. Yeah, the advantage is you get a little tummy tuck also.
Oh, funny.
So,
okay.
But most women continue to have lumpectomies in our country. And for women who opt to remove their breasts, not need to do it because of different reasons for their cancer, but decide that that is better for them, most women do not regret that decision.
Okay.
But it has to be a very carefully thought out, educated decision. And what we know is that removing a healthy breast does not change your overall survival. Meaning, whether you have a lumpectomy or choose to have a bilateral mastectomy, you will not change the outcome from your breast cancer.
Got it. Am I correct in understanding that if one were to have an abnormal mammo, that does not mean that you're headed to the operating room?
Absolutely correct. So a very important takeaway message that I'd like to get across to our listeners today is that there are options. And it doesn't matter what your doctor, if you're dealing with breast cancer or you're dealing with an ear infection, doesn't really matter what it is. The simple question that we should always ask our team of medical professionals, our physicians, is, are there options? What are my options? So you have a mammogram, there's something abnormal that usually leads to more mammograms and possibly an ultrasound. At that point, if the radiologist determines that you need a biopsy, well, that's where you say, what are my options? What types of biopsies are open to me?
Okay.
Well, years ago, it was always a surgical biopsy. You went to the operating room. Thankfully, that's not necessary anymore. So that should not be our first choice in biopsies. We should be doing a biopsy with the mammogram machine or the ultrasound machine or an MRI. But surgical biopsies should not be done just to figure out what's going on the mammogram or ultrasound or MRI. So women should always ask, and men, whatever health condition they have, or what are my options?
Okay, good. Thank you. And I think that that goes for all medical care, really.
Absolutely.
We were talking on the break a little bit about different options for dealing with hot flashes, and you had mentioned that nowadays there are other meds other than hormonal replacement, and also for mood swings that are associated mm-hmm. with menopause. I can tell you, this year alone, I probably have had 4 teenagers come in, and the big issue is relationship with their parents. And as I start to work with what are those issues, it comes out that mom's newly, you know, really having incredible mood swings, and that there's this conflict between the teen having a hormonal shift and the parent having a hormonal shift. And then I'll send the mom to the OB, and she'll come back with a prescription for an SSRI like a Prozac or Zoloft. But what else are they using for hot flashes?
Those are commonly used, specifically one of the SSRIs called Effexor that mm-hmm. has been shown to decrease hot flashes. The other thing that, you know, it goes along with yoga and meditation is acupuncture, which works great. And many, many studies have shown that that helps with hot flashes. And I can only imagine if you're having 10 hot flashes a day and having night sweats and not sleeping well, that you're going to have mood swings.
Right.
I mean, it makes perfect sense.
Right.
But there are ways to deal with that. And as opposed to going to the antidepressants, I would start with the meditation and acupuncture and see if that works, because it works. It helps an enormous amount of women.
With the healthy alternative approaches.
Yes.
I love that. In terms of when you mentioned that, I actually have an acupuncturist, Tom Nash, is scheduled to come in and do an interview with us, and I believe it's in December. So I'll be talking about stress in the holidays and how acupuncture can help with that.
Acupuncture is wonderful, and there's real science behind the benefits. We did a study looking at acupuncture in our cancer center and found that it helps with nausea from chemotherapy. It helps with everything.
Wow.
It really does. It's an amazing, and it's underutilized in our country.
Yeah, absolutely.
In our healthcare system.
Right. I think that it's much more mainstream today than it was, but it's still
not mainstream enough.
Right. Right. So we both have daughters, and, you know, I'm always thinking to myself about the future. What do you see in the future for breast cancer awareness and care?
I think that breast cancer awareness is pretty high. I think that there's a lot of controversies that we have. Our detection, our imaging detection, continues to improve. And the goal of it is not only to improve with diagnosing it, but improve with how we can tell if something is benign, meaning not cancer, or cancer, and avoid these biopsies, avoid the ultrasound-guided biopsies, and avoid the stereotactic biopsies, which are biopsies using the mammogram machine. So our detection needs to continue to improve, and it is, but we also need to get better in how we're figuring out what something is on an image.
Okay, great. I can't thank you enough, Dr. Susan Vogel, for being with us here today from Mount Sinai Beth Israel. If you want to reach Susan, you can reach her at 212-844-6231. Thank you so much. And this is Beth O'Malley with the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour.
And we've got more coming up on 1490 WGCH Greenwich.
USA Radio News with Jason Wirt.
Hillary's corruption shreds the principles on which our nation was founded.
Donald Trump slamming Hillary Clinton as he continues his relentless assault on her character, pointing to the